This is Scott Berguin at KSOW Radio in Cottage Grove, Oregon. We are turning to the issue of Haiti, and we have on the phone Kim Ives, who's a journalist with the Haiti Progrès newspaper and also convener of the International Tribunal on Haiti. Good evening, Kim.
Good evening, Scott.
I really appreciate your taking the time to talk to us and update us on what is going on with Haiti. It's an issue that way out here in Oregon, I know at least, and probably all over the country, you have to work real hard to keep it out in the forefront because people want to forget about it. So can you give us an update on what is going on in Haiti right now? I know there are elections coming up. What do we need to know?
Well, Haiti continues to be occupied by United Nations troops, specifically Brazilians, Argentinians, and Chileans. These are the principal forces there. But in fact, they are being directed by Washington. It was almost 18 months ago that the United States, U.S. Special Forces soldiers kidnapped President Aristide from his home in Tabar, just outside the capital, on February 29th, 2004, and put him on a plane and sent him into exile. He presently is living in exile in South Africa. But the majority of the Haitian people see him still as the legitimate president. And in fact, it could be argued that the majority of people on the planet see him as the legitimate president and understand that what took place was just a vile destabilization campaign conducted by the State Department in conjunction with France and Canada. Even before the coup took place, Canadian, American, and French troops began occupying Haiti and occupied it for 3 months until they handed off the task of keeping the lid on the country to the Brazilian-led UN force.
Okay, I don't want to cut your stream of thought here, but that's something that I guess I didn't know. You're saying that U.S., French, and Canadian troops were in Haiti before the essentially coup occurred?
Yeah, they were, principally the UN, the U.S. forces. Mm-hmm. Canadians were also on the ground before Aristide's plane took off.
Mm-hmm.
And French troops, we are told, were also present in Haiti before Aristide was removed. So it was, they were certainly poised. They were there within 24 hours of his departure. So it was something which was well planned, well coordinated, and this is one of what Aristide calls a modern coup. Nonetheless, has not really been very successful, despite the fact that they immediately set in motion a series of sort of maneuvers to fake a legitimate government, where they set up a tripartite commission, which appointed a 7-member council of sages, which then appointed a prime minister. But none of it really fooled anybody, and the fact is it's an illegal government that's in place. And the Haitian people see it as such and have been leading a very determined and forceful resistance in the months since the coup. Right now, they are trying to solve this problem by holding elections, what in Haiti they're calling selections, because it is very clear that the results are programmed. It's Washington which will decide who will run Haiti, much the same as they've done in Iraq and Afghanistan. And it's pretty much a state of chaos. The supposed technocrat government that they put in place, I say supposed technocrats because they've made such a mess of Haiti in the short time that they've been there, less than 2 years. The price of everything has gone through the roof. The misery of the country, which was already the worst in the hemisphere, has worsened dramatically. Water is unable to be found. Electricity is rare. Garbage piling up in the streets. Hospitals are not functioning. Schools often are not functioning. It is just a very, very dire situation. So these elections, they're thinking, will provide some kind of legitimacy to the government, but in short, the population is by and large boycotting them. Far less than half of the eligible electorate has even bothered to go take an electoral card, despite all sorts of government blackmail, such as saying that without an electoral card you cannot get a driver's license or a visa or a number of other items. So they're calling the electoral card mandatory, but nonetheless still more than half of the country is refusing to take them, which has been the call of the principal parties opposing the coup, such as the Lavalas Family Party and the National Popular Party, or PPN.
So they're calling for people to not register?
Yeah, principally the PPN has been calling for people not to get the electoral cards. The Lavalas Family Party has begun to splinter, actually, into many different factions, so it's a little hard to know what the real Lavalas Family Party is, but the highest council, or what we believe is the highest council, still maintains that the election should be boycotted.
Okay, and what is the date of the election again?
November 20th is the date for the first round, and December 13th for the runoffs.
Okay, does this so-called election have anything to offer, do you think, to the Haitian people?
No, not a thing. It's a pure trap. It's just a way to legitimize the illegal government, and the people in Haiti should fight it tooth and nail.
Okay, so I remember correctly, the last legitimate elections that were held in Haiti, which you can refresh my memory, I believe were observed
November 2000, which is when Aristide was elected.
Right, and he was elected by a significant percentage.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it was also an election that was, that many have called, actually, I hate to bring in other subjects here, but perhaps fairer than the election in our own country the last two presidential elections.
Yeah, absolutely,
but
yeah.
Putting that aside, there was a lot of international observers at that election. And
there were. There was an effort by the U.S. And others to discredit those elections, and it didn't really work, because it was so apparent that Aristide was far and away the winner and would win. But nonetheless, they used a very tenuous charge of seven senators in not even in the November presidential election. This was in May 2000 parliamentary elections. There were seven senators who they claim that the way the runoffs were calculated, that they should have gone to a runoff vote. And the way that the Provisional Electoral Council, which was the supreme arbiter of how those elections were conducted, said no, these people won in the first round. It wasn't any question that they got the majority of votes. It was just whether they should go to a runoff. Well, the U.S., through the OAS, started to make a big to-do about this, which would be as if Haiti started to make a big to-do about the U.S. Supreme Court decision to appoint George Bush president, and said that, you know, it was the wrong way to calculate, or if they'd made a big to-do about the Electoral College vote trumping the popular vote. You know, in fact, it's, as they say in Creole, deux poids, deux mesures, different measures for different people. So it's a tactic that they used to, once they started to challenge the seven senators, then they started to challenge everything about the vote and just upped the rhetoric, repeating it and repeating it in the mainstream press until the general picture that the U.S. population got, who of course aren't following the situation in Haiti carefully,
right,
was that somehow there was a flawed vote and Aristide was a dictator, when in fact the opposite was true. Haiti was the place where you had a more democratic vote and a more democratic president, and the U.S. in fact was resembling more what they were describing in Haiti.
Well, it's a similar process that has gone on with Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, the
exactly.
vilification of the leader,
mm-hmm.
in his case also, of course, somebody who's been elected several times.
Right.
I have a question for me.
Referendums.
This has baffled me from the beginning, and maybe it's completely obvious, but I know I've talked to other people, and often we just scratch our heads and go, what is it about Haiti that gets the U.S. government, in particular, it seems like the Bush family and their folks and their administrations, Daddy and Junior, that gets them so upset? What is it about Haiti that they feel they need to control it?
Two things, Cuba and the Dominican Republic. Haiti is a neighbor of both,
mm-hmm.
and in many ways it is a source of revolutionary danger for U.S. interests in the Caribbean.
Mm-hmm.
There is the larger Antilles, which are essentially Cuba, the island of Hispaniola, or as Haitians call it, Quisqueya, which has Dominican Republic and Haiti and Puerto Rico.
Mm-hmm.
This little chain of islands is geopolitically very important to the U.S., and if Haiti were suddenly to become another Venezuela or another Cuba, this would be a big problem for the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
even though Haiti doesn't have oil or any particular strategic raw material.
Mm-hmm.
So, in many ways, it could be an example, and much as the way it was persecuted during its first 200 years,
mm-hmm.
Having celebrated its bicentennial on January 1st, 2004, it was persecuted for its first 200 years precisely because it was history's only successful slave revolution, and the example that it set for the slaves of the U.S. and the Caribbean, the inspiration that it was for struggling people for centuries, is something that the U.S. is very mindful of. And so when somebody like Aristide emerges, as compromising and as moderate as he was somebody that they saw that needed to be stamped out.
Well, I know that certainly in the case of like Hugo Chavez and I think maybe Aristide and others, that if they even look in the direction or have a conversation with Castro, that's enough to boil some people's blood.
Oh, sure.
So this is kind of a new millennial domino theory here that we're talking about. If Haiti goes, then perhaps the Dominican Republic will go, and so on.
Sure, that's often been advanced, and there is a symbiotic relationship. Although the Dominican Republic has historically, since its beginnings, been sort of constructed, and it's actually in the whole national psyche, I can say, as a bulwark against revolution from Haiti.
Mm-hmm.
The Dominican Republic shares the ignominious distinction of being one of the only countries in the world which chose to be a colony instead of being independent. It was resistant to becoming independent from Spain for a while. But in this sense, it is an extremely explosive situation in the Dominican Republic as well. So again, if you have a democratic nationalist regime in Haiti, which is challenging the U.S.'s prescriptions for the region, neoliberal reforms and austerity, etc., then you are setting an example. And there's a lot of back and forth between Dominican Republic and Haiti. So if you give an inch they are afraid of losing the whole territory. So Haiti was capable of being bullied, and they did.
Well, it's interesting how it appears that real democracy is more of a threat to the U.S. than military dictatorships.
Right. It's only ironic if we accept the wisdom which the mainstream media feeds us, but as many of us know who study the realities of U.S. relations to Latin America and to the world, we find, in fact, that governments are simply kept in place to serve U.S. interests, and often cases that requires a dictatorship.
Right. Well, let's turn back to Aristide briefly. As you said, it sounds like a majority of Haitians still consider Aristide to be the president. Mm-hmm. What are the prospects for this coming to pass, that Aristide returns, which would be for the second time, or the third time, wouldn't it be, after being removed during the first Bush's presidency?
Well, actually, yeah, it would be the second time. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is the second coup against
right.
him. I think the people are keeping that demand. And in Haiti, it really does have a revolutionary potential. You know, to have a revolution in a country, it's a little bit like the formation of life. It takes very specific circumstances. But you have those conditions in Haiti. One of them is that the masses of the people have to be fed up, which is clearly the case in Haiti today. But that's not enough. You also have to have the ruling class fighting among itself. And in 1803, this was the situation in the colony of Santo Domingo. The landowning, in the years leading up to 1803, the landowning newly freed propertied class in Haiti was having a lot of contradictions with the old French planters, and there was sort of a struggle largely over discrimination, racial discrimination that existed at that time, and they were divided, and this allowed a breach really for the Haitian masses, for the slave masses to rise up. In much the same way today, the two ruling classes of Haiti, they are the comprador bourgeoisie, a sort of import-export bourgeoisie, and the big landowning class. These are, we say big landowners, it's not like Central America where you have big latifundia, but they're people who own lots of small plots and rent them to peasants who work them as de moitié, sort of sharecroppers. And these two groups historically had a challenge from the Haitian masses in the form of Aristide. But once Aristide was toppled, they started bickering among each other. So this is the second condition which we find in Haiti. And the third, and maybe the most important, is that just as in 1803, Napoleon Bonaparte found himself with wars on many fronts, Russia, Egypt, England, he was fighting wars everywhere as he was seeking to extend the British Empire. And in many ways, we see that situation today with the superpower of 2005, the U.S., tied up in Iraq, Afghanistan, Colombia, Philippines, South Korea, all over the globe. Its armies are fighting wars and trying to maintain that empire and conquer raw materials, primarily oil, to feed the tremendous appetite of this empire. And essentially, they don't have the troops to put out the many Vietnams that are now emerging. So this is the dilemma, and that's why I think Haiti is in a unique position to really see some kind of revolutionary change. So that all goes back to your original question, will Aristide return? Well, I don't think he's going to return in the way he did in 1994 on the shoulders of U.S. troops. Even the Democrats would be loath to do that. But He may return this time on the shoulders of a genuine national democratic revolution.
Hmm. Okay, well, certainly the people of Haiti have been long suffering, and I know this has been a particularly bloody post-coup period from reports I've seen, and this leads me into your other role, other than a journalist for Haiti Progre newspaper, the convener of the International Tribunal on Haiti.
Yeah. A convener. I'm part of the Haiti Support Network,
okay.
Which was one of the groups which came together. The initiative for the International Tribunal on Haiti actually came from the Latin American Solidarity Coalition, a coalition of groups primarily working around struggles in Central America. And they approached a number of Haitian organizations, among them our own, and said, we want to have a tribunal which will judge. They were really wanted to go after the National Endowment for Democracy and the International Republican Institute, an arm of, in the NED, which, as many of your listeners may know, is sort of a quasi-governmental organization which was spawned under the Reagan administration in 1983 to really do the political work that the CIA used to do of subverting governments and funding opposition groups and stuff that they can do. Well, they think it's legal. It's actually illegal. It would be illegal in this country. You aren't allowed to have foreign powers funding political campaigns here.
Right.
But they see no, again, du poids du mesure, they see no problem in doing that in other countries. So that's what they use NED to do. So that was the original idea, was to judge NED. But that would have been really another symbolic trial, a sort of a mock trial. And we began to think about it, and what we realized was really we have another option, and we're trying to do something new with this international tribunal, because there now exists a thing called the International Criminal Court, which was formed about 3 or 4 years ago. It now has majority of nations on the earth signatories to it. And essentially what the court can do is judge individuals in countries where the justice system is not functioning. And that certainly is a description of Haiti. So the idea we came with was let's do a trial which isn't just symbolic, but which really is a precursor to an international criminal court judgment. Let's compile a dossier which we submit to the International Criminal Court and force them, demand of them, to take action against the people who today are committing crimes against humanity and are slaughtering the Haitian people. And this includes not only members of the Haitian National Police and the so-called rebels who massacred hundreds of people in their antics leading up to Jean-Bertrand Aristide's overthrow, but also the UN commanders who have been carrying out massacres in the slums like Bel Air and Cité Soleil, U.S., French, and Canadian commanders who have been also carrying out those massacres, as well as the civilian officials who are overseeing this slaughter. So we really got the idea when, in fact, the Haitian bourgeoisie, back in June, summoned the head of the UN peacekeeping force, quote-unquote peacekeeping force, we could really call it a war-making force, and said, why aren't you acting more forcefully against the people in the slums who are resisting? And he said, listen, George Bush can do what he wants, but myself, I have to worry about being tried, and I'm not going to be tried in Haiti. I could be judged internationally, so I'm going to be careful. And that's when we said, aha, let's put the pressure there, because the Brazilians, the Argentinians, the Chileans, you know, they remember the case of Pinochet being picked up there and in England by a Spanish judge. So they're very sensitive to the notion of the International Criminal Court. They are all signatories to it. And so we say, let's put the pressure there. And we're going to, in a way disrupt their chain of command.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to judge those people carrying out those massacres. Granted, it's not George Bush, but at least George Bush isn't going to be able to use some proxies to carry out his dirty work. If he's going to do it, he's going to have to find some more troops, and I don't know where he's going to get them.
So what is your timeline for this tribunal?
We're looking at about 7 or 8 months. Mm-hmm. We held the first session in Washington just prior to the big march that happened on September 24th.
Mm-hmm.
On September 23rd, the night of September 23rd, we had about 400 people gather at George Washington University for the opening session. We had 7 witnesses, a jury of 15, and we found 3 of the 21 indicted officials guilty. Those were Leon Charles, the former head of the Haitian National Police, Juan Gabriel Valdez, the civilian head of the UN mission to stabilize Haiti, or MINUSTA, and Augusto Heleno Pereira, who was the Brazilian head of the MINUSTA's armed wing.
Hmm.
So those 3 were found guilty, and we have going to Haiti this Thursday a commission of inquiry headed by former Attorney General Ramsey Clark, which is going to Haiti to collect more testimony and affidavits and evidence for the next session of the tribunal, which will take place in Boston on November 19th.
Okay. We're coming up close to probably a good time to cut this off, close to a half an hour. I really appreciate your time explaining these things, and I think that what we should end with perhaps is your thoughts on how listeners, what's the best way for listeners to get involved or help give support for the Haitian people?
Well, one of the principal things they can do is support the International Tribunal, which is taking place. They can contribute online by going to the website of the Nicaragua Network, and online there is a on the donation page you'll see an item for the International Tribunal on Haiti. So go to the Nicaragua Network's webpage. That's nicanet.org. And you will find it. I'm pretty sure it's nicanet.org.
So nicanet, like N-I-C-A-N-E-T?
Yeah, N-E-T dot org. And then people can also, I'll just double check it while I'm talking
okay.
to you. By supporting that, they will be supporting the people's capacity to resist. It's really something that we saw going beyond demonstrations, beyond letters to your congressman, etc. This is really a way to stay the hand of the massacres, because if they know that there's a tribunal which is looking at everybody who is ordering or taking responsibility for these massacres, they're going to think twice. And so in that sense, we're seeing a way for the diaspora and for people here in the U.S. to participate. But it's something that we have to do. We have no institutional backing to do this. It requires a lot of airfares and outlays, so we really need people to contribute to that. And if they can go, the other place they can send money is to the Haiti Support Network, which is also helping to organize the tribunal, and that is at 1398 Flatbush Avenue in Brooklyn, New York. That's 1398 Flatbush Avenue, Brooklyn, New York, 11210.
All right, fantastic. Well, as in a lot of these international issues, it's important, as you said, it's important for the public to be aware and let the people who now hold the power know that people are watching. As they say, the whole world's watching. Let's hope we can make that true and truly help the Haitian people to help themselves, basically, and take back their country.
Yeah. Well, I think it's in the course of happening, and if people here can do their utmost to support that resistance and to show their support. solidarity with the Haitian resistance, I think it's going to win. I think they're losing this battle.
Okay. Well, that is good news, and hopefully this will turn out to be true with help from a lot of people. And Kim, again, appreciate your spending the time, and I will check back with you, especially as we get closer to the time that the tribunal starts, or at least the next part of the tribunal happens in November.
Right. Thanks very much, Scott.
You bet, Kim. Bye.
Okay, bye.